things. This is just, you can gather from the papers I've handed round. We've come this evening in our studies to the Garden of Gethsemane. It's going to be around midnight when the Lord Jesus was to cross the Kidron River, Kidron Valley, with his disciples to enter into the garden. What we've done on the first of the pieces of paper you've got is to give the parallel accounts of the three synoptic gospels mainly. John only adds one verse to the situation as far as Gethsemane is concerned. And then on the second, we've suggested what we believe is the actual chronological order of Gethsemane. We'll have reasons for putting it in this order as we go through the incident of Gethsemane, but it pretty well follows what we would expect it to do. There is an amazing sort of link between what happened in Gethsemane and the rest of the scriptures, as we would expect. Now, rather than keep going from the one quotation to the other, I thought if we could refer to the list we put down, it may help us to not only save a bit of time, but to stop getting as confused as we would. So I'm going to use the order which I put down here as the basis for our remarks. And so we're going to start with John chapter 18 and verse 1, and then go through them in the sequence, and then you can compare it afterwards as to whether you agree with the order, and no doubt we'll have plenty of things to say in discussion. So John chapter 18 verse 1, which is the only comment John really makes concerning the ordeal in the Garden of Gethsemane. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where was a garden, into the which he entered with his disciples. Now the word for brook there in verse 1 of John chapter 18 is interesting. It literally means, according to Strong, a torrent, as in strong flowing. And it is suggested that as this was Passover time, it was quite normal to expect the latter rains which we have in the Old Testament. Remember Joel in his prophecy in chapter 2 speaks of the former and the latter rains, and this is the rainy period of the winter months, as we would say, starting around October, when you've got what's termed by the Jews the former rain, and then around about the March-April time we have the latter rains. Obviously between April and October it doesn't rain basically in the land of Israel, so they always refer to the rainy season as from October to March or April. And so the Passover was the time when they would have the latter rains. And it is suggested that the Kidron Valley was in flood at the time when the Lord crossed over into Gethsemane. That's not unusual. Even in today's climate, the Kidron Valley occasionally gets flooded with the flash floods which come with the heavy rains of the spring. And so it is not so unusual, and particularly in those days, it was quite normal for there to be water in the brook Kidron. We get a bit blasé today because all the pictures we see is obviously of a dried up valley. But it is more than likely that the Lord and the disciples had to cross over the Kidron, which was in flood at the time. There's an interesting quotation in the Psalms. If you go to Psalm 110, which speaks of the order of Melchizedek, as we know, there's an interesting verse at the end of Psalm 110, And verse 7 says, he shall drink of the brook in the way. Therefore shall he lift up his head. Whether that's to be understood in a literal sense, or in the spiritual sense as we would generally understand Psalm 110, remains to be thought about. But it may well be that, to refresh, the Lord actually partook of the brook Kidron on his way over into the garden. That's just as an aside. You'll notice, coming back to John chapter 18, that he went into a garden. Now, what can we say about the garden which hasn't been said and thought by you and many others hundreds of times before? The Garden of Gethsemane occupies our thoughts on many occasions. We've obviously got a lot of parallels between the first garden mentioned in the scriptures, that of Eden, and the garden here of Gethsemane. Mike Ashton, if you remember, the Dudley First Street Fraternal spoke of the contrast between Eden and Gethsemane as the garden. In the first garden, the temptation was succumbed to, and sin entered into the world. Here, he was triumphed over it, and sin was conquered. Was into a garden tomb that the Lord was also placed. And so gardens are very significant. We're not going to dwell too much on the gardens. I want to really try and get to grips with Gethsemane. I think it would be fair to say, brothers and sisters, and again, I'd appreciate you coming afterwards, to really understand the thoughts of the Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane, you've got to really be an expert and a student of the Psalms. And I ain't. The Psalms are very beautiful and wonderful. I can't say I could get to grips with them that way. But I think if we could open up the Psalms, then I think Garden of Gethsemane would become far more clear in our minds. And I think some of the difficulties we have with some of the things which the Lord says probably would evaporate if we had a clear understanding of what the Psalms foretold concerning his thoughts and his mind at this time. We can only say a few things about it, but no doubt in the discussion there'll be other things which you could add greatly to these things, because the book of Psalms is not quite my sort of subject, unfortunately. Anyway, we'll do what we can. Let's go to the next reference, which is Luke chapter 22. Because there Luke tells us something which we don't take, well, we're not surprised by, and yet in one sense we should be. Luke chapter 22 and verse 39 says, Jesus often went to the garden of the Mount of Olives. John has told us that Judas knew the place where the Lord would be, because he oftentimes resorted thither with his disciples. So the Garden of Gethsemane was a well-known spot to see the Lord praying unto his Father. And yet it's the only time it's mentioned in the scriptures. Not mentioned before in the Gospels at all. We're not told ever before that he went there. And yet the record tells us here that he went there often. Now we have many records of him going up to a mountain to pray, to go to the deserts to pray, and all the other different places he prayed. But we are not told anywhere in the Gospels that he went to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. But here, when it comes to the incident of the garden, he tells us that he did. So presumably, on the occasions when he went to Bethany, he must have also visited Gethsemane. It must have been quite a sacred place as far as the Master was concerned. Because if you notice in Luke chapter 22 and in verse 40, the record specifically says And when he was at that place, he said unto them, as if there was a specific spot of those, a favourite place where the Lord often resorted. I tried to exercise the mind and failed miserably. As to what historical or biblical connection there could be with this spot on the foothills of the Mount of Olives, I couldn't find it. You can have many allusions to the valley and to the brook and all the other things, but I couldn't find anything which suggested that there was a particular spot in the scriptures where he would go. We can think about Moriah, which obviously wasn't very far away. We can think about other sacred places. But I fail to come up with anything in my own mind, but no doubt I'm going to be enlightened afterwards, as to what in Old Testament times this place could be. It seemed like that it was a specific place. One writer suggested it was the place where animal sacrifices were done when the temple was built. I see no relevance whatsoever in that. I can't see any reference in the Old Testament that there was a garden on the foothills of Olivet. And so, almost without any preface, without any guide to the significance of Gethsemane, it becomes possibly, with Golgotha, the most important spot in the whole of the scriptures. And yet we're not given the background to it. But it was a place we know for certain where the Lord often had gone. He'd went there with his disciples because Judas knew exactly where it was. The word Gethsemane, as I'm sure you all know, means an oil press. The spot which people suggest is the place of Gethsemane today is full of olive trees, and there's no reason why it's not in that vicinity, because it was certainly very close to it. And so the olive oil press, which was probably in a garden of olive trees, would seem to be the significance of the name Gethsemane. So it was probably an olive press in a garden or an orchard of olive trees. Now the thing about Gethsemane is something which occurs so often through the Gospels. We've got a repetition of three. We've got the Lord taking three disciples with him, not the 11. We've got the Lord praying three times. And three times he comes back and finds the disciples asleep. Now we can't rule out, there must be a link somewhere between the transfiguration, when there was three disciples, the same three, and three men, Jesus, Moses and Elijah. We can't rule out the fact of the three tabernacles which Peter wanted, if the Lord found them asleep. We think of the three temptations in the wilderness. We think of Peter denying his Lord three times, of being asked by his Lord three times whether he loved him. And we've got this repetition of three throughout the Gospels, or throughout the life of the Lord. And we go through again. Three times the Master was to pray. As you go. You go back to the Old Testament again, you think of Daniel. Morning, noon, and night he prayed to his God three times a day. We find him in Daniel 10 praying three different ways. We find Elijah and Elisha spoken of as threes when they raised people from the dead. We think of the fact of Elijah praying three times before the cloud appeared. We've got an incredible repetition of threes. But again, we're going to put that on one side without pursuing it, because I'm sure, again, you've considered it many times before. What we want to try and do is capture the spirit of Gethsemane in some small way, brothers and sisters. And so he first of all comes with the 11 disciples, and verse 40 of Luke chapter 22 is the first words that he was to utter to them. He tells them, "Pray that you enter not into temptation." This, I suggest, wasn't just to the three, but was to the 11. Men ought always to pray and not to grow weary. We always ought to keep on praying as the Lord has exhorted us on so many occasions. And so again he says here, pray that you enter not into temptation. It was not specifically to Peter, nor to James, nor to John, but he said unto them, unto the 11, the disciples who followed him into the garden, that you enter not into temptation. What an exhortation to us, brothers and sisters. So he then says unto the disciples, as we've got in the next order, as Matthew records, that he leaves the 8 disciples and takes with him just 3, and he tells the 8 to sit here while I go and pray yonder. So again, let's find a picture in our minds, brothers and sisters. It's obviously midnight. It was dark. That dark and mournful night when the Lord, crossing the Kidron, enters into the garden. He says to the 11 disciples, pray that you enter not into temptation. And then he leaves 8 and takes 3 with him. And he says to the 8, sit you here while I go and pray yonder. And he takes with him, so we're told by Mark's account, in verse 33, Peter, James, and John, the 3 special disciples. I've often wondered, and some of you have heard me remark before, I know the fact that on so many other special occasions, he was to single out Peter, James, and John, that the Lord was indicating that some disciples are closer to him than others. Thank you. Because it was only a small band altogether. 11 men, as it was now. Even 12 before was not a huge number. And yet out of that number, he chooses 3 special disciples. And out of those 3, he had one specifically who he loved much. As if there is this indication by the Lord that some disciples are more precious in his sight than others for various reasons according to his will and understanding. But it's something which we have to consider. Can we go to Matthew's account of you, my brothers and sisters? Matthew 26. Verse 37 says, he takes with him Peter, but this time not James and John, as Mark has told us, but the 2 sons of Zebedee, sons of thunder. And it is while he was with the 3 that he begins to be sorrowful and very heavy, and says, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. So it was while he was with the 3 brothers and sisters that he begins to pour out his most innermost feelings. And there is no question that the margin between the master and the disciples in Gethsemane reaches its closest. The master, remember we've seen before, it is enough for the disciple that he be as his master. It's almost here in Gethsemane the master is as the disciple. And it's with those special three that he pours out his heart and his thoughts. And the record tells us he was sorrowful even unto death, exceedingly sorrowful and very troubled. So the Lord obviously broke down. The emotion would have poured out of him, brothers and sisters, as we're going to see with some of the Psalms in a little while. And here, before for free, he makes his feelings known. Can we just go back to Mark's account? Because Mark adds a comment in Mark chapter 14. Which I think, again, we do well to ponder. Verse 33, and he taketh with him Peter and James and John, and began to be sore amazed. And the word amazed, according to Strong, is terrifying. He was affrighted. What was he sore afraid of, brothers and sisters? What terror had so gripped the Lord that he pours out his innermost feelings to his disciples at this time? Some, in trying to lessen the effect, suggested that he was sorrowful for his disciples because of what they were going to endure. That was obviously always in his mind, brothers and sisters, because he prayed for them on many occasions. I would suggest here this was the feelings of the master himself. He was affrighted. Perhaps one of the Psalms begins to unfold his feelings. Psalm 18. Each one of these psalms that we're going to look at, we really should read the whole of them because it puts the total balance of the way that the Lord prays unto his God, his rock and his fortress, his deliverer. But I just want to emphasise what the psalms also have to say concerning his innermost feelings at this time. Verse 4. The sorrows of death compass me. The floods of ungodly men made me afraid. The sorrows of hell compass me about. The snares of death prevented me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. And so the master, brothers and sisters, had the sorrows of death encompassing him, as verse 4 says. Let's go to Psalm 42. Psalm 42. Verse 5. You know the words better, perhaps, than Psalm 18. Psalm 42, verse 5. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted? As if the Lord was almost questioning his own thoughts at this time, as to why these thoughts were there, that he was affrighted. That the very realization of what had got to be accomplished in the next few hours suddenly was outpouring from his heart and mind as the hour grew ever closer.
Perhaps it's a verse in John's Gospel in chapter 12, in an earlier incident, which might throw a bit of thought to this. Remember verse 27, which we saw at the time. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause I came to this hour. So he'd had these thoughts a few days earlier. But now, brothers and sisters, the full realization was now being poured out before his disciples. So he goes to the only source wherein there was comfort and strength. He says to his disciples, "Tarry ye here while I go and pray." Notice in the suggested order, Matthew 26 and verse 38 says, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me." But they don't. Now again, brothers and sisters, there's a number of thoughts we can have on this. I think it was too much for them to cope with. Or it was too much for the Lord to express it before others to get them as upset as he was, and they had to withdraw himself. Or he was so anxious that they gave him fellowship and companionship and love and comfort at this time. But they couldn't. But the Lord asked them to watch with him. To watch what for? "Tarry ye here and watch with me." So can you do this? But what I say unto you, I say unto you all, watch. But that's not the thing. Verse 41 tells us now, of Luke chapter 22, you'll notice in the order, that he leaves the three and he was withdrawn from them a stone's cast. So those who have been to the suggested garden as it is today outside Jerusalem, you could easily throw a stone from one end to the other. The Lord here was in the garden. He'd separated from the 11 disciples, and he was now with only the three, and he separated a stone's cast. We're not told how far that is, but you know, we can all imagine how far we could throw a stone. So it must have been a fairly impressive size of God. And he went from them about a stone's cast. Whether he went from them that distance, brothers and sisters, or whether Luke tells us that that was that distance, so they couldn't hear. We're not specifically told, but I would suggest that. But Luke tells us the distance to give us the impression that the disciples could not hear what the Lord was now praying. This was going to be the work of the Father and the Son. And as Genesis chapter 22 says, they went both of them together, as it said so often of Abraham and Isaac. This was now going to be the work of the Father and the Son, because the Jewish world had been conquered. The prince of this world had got nothing in the Lord. The temptations had all failed. They could not lay one charge against him. This was now the battle himself. All the other victories had been accomplished, and it was now only the Father in this great time of the Lord. As let's read it, friends, this says we know the word so well, but let's read it. Isaiah 53. Well, Alan's very good with the hymn book, and he can quote me some of our hymns, which are very beautiful in this regard, when we consider this man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Verse 3 of Isaiah 53. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. I wonder if that in verse 3 has any suggestion whatsoever that when he asked his disciples to watch with him, they couldn't. And he withdrew the stone's cast. They represented a ball. They hid, as it were, their faces from him. Surely, says verse 4, he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgression, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. With his stripes we are healed. So the sins of humanity, brothers and sisters, were now weighing down upon him. As this was going to be the bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement of our peace was upon him. With his stripes we are healed. So the sins of humanity, brothers and sisters, were now weighing down upon him. As this was going to be the battle of all battles. Because here, death was going to be finally conquered. Because what was going to happen subsequent, brothers and sisters, was, if I can use the term, a formality in consequence to what happened here. And the reason I say that is because of what John tells us. Then we go to John's Gospel and chapter 18. We're going to go on and look at it in detail. But the Lord prayed to his Father three times that the cup may pass from him. We're going to have a look in detail as to what we suggest that might be, which I think is one of the most difficult to really comprehend in the whole of the Scriptures. The one thing we do know for certain, brothers and sisters, that in John chapter 18 and in verse 11, after Simon Peter drew his sword to defend the Master against Malchus, and as we suggested last time, Malchus had already smitten the Lord with the sword, and Peter was defending him. But verse 11 says, "Then said Jesus unto Peter, Put up thy sword into thy sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" And there was no question now, we're talking about an hour or so later, that the cup which he'd asked to be passed from him, he was now willing and able and ready to drink of it. The battle had been won. And what the scribes and the Pharisees and Annas and the Romans might do, couldn't deny that will now, which the Master had to drink of the cup which the Father had given him. And so I think the crisis of Isaiah 53 was here in Gethsemane. Because he had now determined, so something, brothers and sisters, happened in Gethsemane for him to say those wonderful words which he now says to Peter. And I believe the answer is in the prayer which he now makes with his Father. Can we come back to Mark's account, Mark chapter 14?
Only Mark records this. Verse 35. He went forward a little and fell upon the ground. Look at your order, brothers and sisters, and look what Luke has told us. Luke says he kneeled down and prayed. Mark goes one stage further. He now prostrates himself upon the ground. He went forward a little and fell on the ground, brothers and sisters. I don't think it was just because of exhaustion, although that certainly was a factor in the proceedings here. The Lord prostrated himself before the majesty of God. And he prayed that if it was possible, the hour might pass from him. And then he uses a phrase which the Apostle Paul was to use later on, in connection with the promises and the confirmation of the great hope that we have. When in verse 36 he said, Abba, Father. I think rightly we assume that the one is the Hebrew for Father and the other one is the Greek for Father. You've got to remember that Abba originally is an Aramaic expression. It's not a Hebrew expression. It's not found in the Old Testament scriptures. It is an Aramaic expression, but apparently, according to Josephus, it was adopted by the Jews, and apparently, again, Abba was the first word a Jewish child could speak, because it's a very easy one for them to express. I'm not an expert on child psychology, but that's what they sound. And so it was not a Hebrew word. It was an Aramaic word. But it generally is assumed and accepted that in the days of the New Testament, Abba was used by the Jews as the expression of Father, where the other word there in verse 36 is the Greek word pater, which is the Greek word for Father. And so what the Master was trying to do, again giving the confirmation of what Paul does, is bring Jew and Gentile into this confirmation of the Abrahamic promises. That doesn't help us with the next thing, brothers and sisters, but there's something which I think, again, we need to just to think about. If we go to John's Gospel in chapter 17, like I said, what we're trying to do is capture the spirit of the events of Gethsemane, the intensity which was in the heart and mind of the Lord. Remember John chapter 17, in that prayer which he uttered before he entered into the garden. Notice, we've got in verse 1, Father, the hour is come. And then in verse 5 he says, O Father. And then in verse 11, he says, Holy Father. And then in verse 25, he says, Righteous Father. As if there's a growing intensity in his approach to his God and to his Father. And I wonder again, brothers and sisters, when we think of the words of Mark here, Abba, Father, whether Mark is indicating how the Lord, on the three occasions, approached the Father, perhaps in a more intense way each time. Father, Holy Father, Righteous Father. What we do know, brothers and sisters, is what the Hebrew man tells us about what was happening here in the garden. Hebrews chapter 5. Now, thankful we are that Hebrews chapter 5 tells us something remarkable about the manner of the Lord here in the garden. Verse 7. Who in the days of his flesh
when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared. And I would suggest that is more poignant of the Garden of Gethsemane than even the cross. That the Lord, brother and sister, offered up prayers with strong crying and tears. We're told a little later on in the account of Gethsemane that the sweat rolled from him, as it were, great drops of blood. The tears would have poured out of his eyes as he prayed unto his fathers with great crying and tears. The emotion, brothers and sisters, leaves us speechless as the sorrow for the heaviness and all the things which were in the turmoil of heart and mind, brothers and sisters, poured out of the Lord as he now prostrates himself before his Father. Verse 36 of Mark 14. All things are possible unto me. We know where the words are taken from, brothers and sisters. They first appear, as you remember, in the account when Sarah and Abraham were told they would have a child. And Sarah laughed. And God said, nothing is impossible with you. It was also true at the time of the birth, or the conception of John the Baptist, and of the Lord himself. All things are possible with God. So Romans 4 is where the apostle takes up the theme that God is able to perform what he has promised. But are all things possible, brothers and sisters? Was it possible that if verse 35 and verse 36 of Mark chapter 14 were literally meant to be understood as to save him from death, was that possible with God? Well, to raise men from the dead is quite possible. But was it possible, brothers and sisters, for this cup to be taken away if we take it in that sense? Again, you just keep your finger there. Go back to Hebrews chapter 5. And again, perhaps the Hebrew man in Hebrews chapter 5 gives us a better understanding. Because we know the words well, we tend to read them as they are, rather than how they should be. When he'd offered up prayers and supplications, says verse 7, with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him out of death. Not from death. It's the Greek word ek, as we've got in ecclesia. The Diaglot, the Revised Version Margin, and other places show us that he was not able to save him from death. That's not what the Lord was praying for. But he was saving him out of death. So all things were possible, providing those things which were written were to be accomplished. The whole purpose of God now, brothers and sisters, depended upon his own. So how was it possible for the Lord to grant, or the Almighty, to grant the Lord's request? In one sense, brothers and sisters, it was not possible that the cup could pass on. And although we like to use the caveat that the Master says, not what I will, but what thou wilt, I and my Father are one. I have power to lay down my life and I have power to take it up again. After 3 days, I will be taken by the chief priest, I will be killed, and after 3 days I will rise up from the dead. The Son of Man must be lifted up. There was never a question, brothers and sisters, in the mind of the Lord ever, never a question, as to what the will and purpose of his God and of himself was. The saving of humanity, brothers and sisters, was there clearly outlined in the scriptures of truth, and I come to do thy will, O my God, in the volume of the book which is written of me. So I think we've got to be careful when we look at verse 36. When the Master is saying something, that must be true. All things are possible unto thee. And there must be, brothers and sisters, a total truth that all things must be possible. Because the Lord Jesus would not have asked his Father to do that which is impossible to do. Remember those very well-known words of John chapter 3. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And those words which we just quoted verbatim, we must re-emphasize, brothers and sisters, in verse 14. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. He says it again in John chapter 12. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of the world be cast down. And if I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men unto me. He must be lifted up, brothers and sisters. There's no question about it. So he is not asking the Father to do something which was impossible. I think we've got to appreciate that. So what he was asking the Father to do must have been possible. So how if we understand what the Lord was praying for, he must have been praying for something which he knew it was possible for the Father to do. Can we go to the order of Gethsemane, brothers and sisters, or my suggestion to you that? Can we come down to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 42 on the second page? Matthew chapter 26 and verse 42. He went away again the second time and prayed, saying exactly the same thing. Because Mark 14 verse 39 says, he spake the same words. So the prayer on the first occasion was exactly the prayer on the second occasion. And verse 44 of Matthew 26, he left them and went away and prayed the third time, saying the same words. So three times, brothers and sisters, the Lord said exactly the same thing. The same prayer was offered three times with growing intensity. So three times the Lord was saying, it is possible, Lord, for you to do this. He wouldn't have asked the Almighty three times for something which was impossible. And so he knew that the Lord could grant it. The difference between the first two occasions and the third is Luke chapter 22 verse 43. There appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was in great drops of blood falling to the ground. And then he comes back to the disciples, ready to face everything. And so the third time, brothers and sisters, the Father strengthened him by the presence of, without question, Gabriel, angel who had appeared in the earth, is now going to appear in the garden. Although he doesn't tell us, I have no doubt in my own mind, although he thinks I can be certain of almost, in the garden, that it was Gabriel who came unto him. Now, let's have a look at this, because it is really, really important, but also, without question, difficult, as to what the Lord was actually praying for. When he was saying, "Father, let this cup pass from me," did he mean? And if he did, which he did, what did he mean? He wasn't praying for something which was not possible. Well, I tried to suggest that to sisters. So what did he say? There's a number of suggestions, and if you would bear with me, brothers and sisters, I'd like to put them all to you. All of them have been suggested by Christadelphian writers and Christadelphian brethren, maybe sisters as well, at some time or another. They're back in the days of Brother Roberts onwards. The first thing which some would suggest is that the cup he wanted to pass from him was the suffering in the garden. Some actually say that. That the Lord felt the shame and the suffering was too much for him to bear. And he was asking his Father to take that away. I'm not going to make any comment as we go through the brothers and sisters. I'm going to try and give them as honestly as the brethren have suggested. And then we can have a think about them, we can talk about them, and I will also give you what my personal opinion is as it is. That's the first one. The second one is something taken from the Psalms, like we've suggested everything is really taken from the Psalms. Can we go to Psalm chapter 6? And what the Lord was asking for was that he wouldn't spend more than a second in the death state. So he was praying that this cup may pass from him, not in the sense of the actual death, but the actual timing of death. And the reason that is suggested by some is because of Psalm 6, an experience of Psalm 6 verse 4. Psalm 6 and verse 4, verse 4, "Return, O Lord, deliver my soul, O save me for thy mercy's sake, for in death there is no remembrance of me, in the grave who shall give thee thanks?" So as soon as the Lord expired, there was no way he could praise his God, and he couldn't bear the thought. Now, when I tell you, there was one man in the Old Testament scriptures who actually expressed this and had his prayer granted. And of course, that was Hezekiah. Because in Isaiah chapter 38, those words which we've just seen in Psalm 6 were the very expressions which Hezekiah used. Isaiah 38, he was sick unto death. He was praying for God to extend his life. Verse 18, Isaiah 38. "For the grave cannot praise thee, death that cannot celebrate thee, they that go down into the pit cannot hope for thy truth. The living, he shall praise thee as I do this die. The father to the children shall make known thy truth. And the Lord answered his prayer in 15 years was added to his life. But in death we cannot praise the Lord. And so the Lord would pine, some suggest, that it was not the actual death, but that he didn't understand any time of death. Now again, let's think about that, brothers and sisters, logically for a moment. So I'll go into the 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is not what the writer has said. I'm adding to what the writer has said to give a bit more credence to what's just been written in the Psalms. Because it's not as daft as it might sound on first thought. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, which we know well. For I delivered unto you, first of all, that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures. Genesis 22, Isaiah 53, Exodus 12, But verse 4 obviously comes in one place only. And he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, according to the Scriptures. It was only the sign of the prophet Jonah in the Old Testament Scriptures which told us that. Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the fish's belly. He wasn't dead. Jonah chapter 2 tells us that he spoke and prayed while he was in the fish's belly. So all the time, in the 3 days and three nights, he was conscious. So he could praise his God. Now, when in the Old Testament Scriptures does it say, brothers and sisters, that the Lord had to experience death in the sense of a time in death? You're going to quote Psalm 16, when he says he will not suffer his Holy One to see corruption. So that means instantly God could have raised him from the dead, because it was not possible that the grave should hold him. He'd done no sin, neither was God. And so some suggest what the Lord was praying for is that this cup might pass from him in an instant. That the cup of death, which he was willing to drink of, might be over in a second. And he would be able to praise his God for everything. The third suggestion, brothers and sisters, is again taken from the Psalms. Psalm 13. I'm not trying to make something which is simple complicated by any means. I think it's vitally important that we try and understand what the Lord was praying for, because it really is the crux of the whole matter. Psalm 13. I'm sure you've had these thoughts before, but Psalm 13 is quite amazing, really. Look at verse 1. It's only a short psalm. How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord? How long will I hide thy face from thee? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Light mine eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed against him. And those that trouble me rejoice when I am moved. But I have trusted in my mercy, my heart shall rejoice in my salvation. Let this cup pass from me, that my enemies don't see it as a triumph. Don't let them rejoice, thinking that you've rendered me powerless to save. Let defeat be turned into victory for my sake, O Lord. Go to Psalm 35 and we might see the reading clearer. Again, this is a suggestion. Psalm 35. Verse 19. Let not them that are mine enemies wrongfully rejoice over me, neither let them wink with the eye that hate me without a cause. For they speak not peace, but they devise deceitful matters against them that are quiet in the land. Yea, They opened their mouth wide against me and said, Aha, aha, our eye has seen it. This thou hast seen, Lord, keep not silent. So, Lord, be not far from me. Verse 25, let them not say in their hearts, Ah, so would we have had it. Let them not say, we have swallowed them up, swallowed him up something. Let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together, that rejoice at my heart. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor, that magnify themselves against me. So the Lord was praying that in the moment of the cup having to be drunk, the enemy would not think they had triumphed. But the Lord God would cause the cup to pass from him in the sense of the shame and degradation, in order that his name may be glorified and the enemy would see that they had lost. The fourth suggestion, brothers and sisters, is possibly the most popular one. When I say popular, perhaps the one said by more writers than any of the others. Now, it can always be, as generations follow generation, that the one has simply plagiarized the other, copied the other. It may well be that they have considered what the others have said and made their own opinion that they were right. It's very difficult to know what the brothers have before them. We hope to think we've formed our own opinions, but perhaps we've been influenced by the arguments of others. But this tends to be the one which most writers suggest more than any other. As we've suggested, it was after midnight. The fact that the disciples were exhausted, the fact that they went to sleep, is very obvious. He was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. The sins of humanity were weighing down upon him. And therefore, without question, the Lord was utterly exhausted. And when you get into an exhausted state, brothers and sisters, things which were not a problem become a major problem. Things which you could cope with, you no longer don't want to. You haven't got the effort. I can't cope with this. Let it pass on. The Psalms seem to indicate that this might be a factor. Can we go to Psalm 31 for us? So what the suggestion is here, that something which was very real for him at the time because of his utter exhaustion and state of mind seemed totally insurmountable, and yet when he was strengthened he was able to actually overcome them. And so what the Lord did in the final prayer by sending an angel to strengthen him was basically to give him energy again, to almost refresh him, so he could then carry on the case. And so these thoughts were going through his mind, some were suggested, when he was in this utterly weak state. That things which were not so became very real, and he thought they were so. Psalm